Today on No Limits, we're going to go boldly where many now have gone before, into the world of Star Trek. This Thursday marks the 50th anniversary of the show's premiere. We're going to discuss the show's creation, explore the sources of its enduring appeal, and just share fun stories about what it means to be a Trekker. My guests are Star Trek historian Will Smith, two members of the local Star Trek-themed band Five-Year Mission, Andy Fark and Chris Spurgeon, and Star Trek devotee Dave Arland of Arland Communications. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on social media. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We have a really fun show today. This week marks the 50th anniversary of the original Star Trek TV series. We're going to be talking about that show and the Star Trek phenomenon today. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Dave Arland of Arland Communications, who is also a well-known local Trekker, Will Smith, who's a Star Trek historian and operator of TOSGraphics.com, and TOS stands for the original series, and Andy Fark and Chris Spurgeon of the band Five-Year Mission. They're with us here, and actually that was one of their songs we heard coming into the show. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, I'm going to start, and I think, you know, to sort of establish this, because Star Trek exists, obviously, as a show, but it's really also about the relationships. I mean, it's one of those things that's been sustained as much by the audience as it has been by the creators, in some cases maybe even more. So I'd like to start just by talking about, you know, how each of you discovered Star Trek and when that moment when it stopped being an interest and became a passion. So I'll start with Dave on that one.
Well, that's an easy one for me. I don't know how many of the listeners can remember Channel 13 years ago in the early 70s used to run Star Trek every night after the news.
And oh, yeah.
Bob Gregory and John Lindsay and the whole news team, they used to beam aboard the Enterprise at the end of the newscast. And I know my mom's listening right now, and I remember playing Canasta one night. We did that as a family, and it was probably a Friday night or something. And all of a sudden, they beamed aboard the Enterprise, and I was like, what is that? You know, I was all of 9 years old, I think, at that time. And I got hooked pretty easily. This was after the series had ended. The original series only ran for 3 years, 79 episodes. But that was like the perfect length to push it into syndication. And the creator of Star Trek, Gene Roddenberry, did a deal and got it into syndication very quickly. The studio and the network couldn't care less. They had other stuff on their minds. And that was the seed that got planted. I think, to answer your question about when it really took off and became something more than you watch every night, is when my dad came home from work one night. He was working over on Post Road at the Hook store there. He's a pharmacist. And he came home holding a flyer and said, at the Warren Public Library, there's a Star Trek club that's going to meet tonight, and I want you to come and get in the car, and I'll drive you. He drove out to our home, 20 miles back to the library, and here sat a 12-year-old or whatever, just enamored at other people like me, and that was before the internet, you know, so that's what's so cool about it.
Well, and Will, that is a much more typical, because that Dave's story with a few minor variations was my story with Star Trek too, in that I was in theory could have watched it when it was in its original network run, but you know, in those days families had one television set and children generally didn't get to determine what was going to be watched. There were certain shows that we watched as a family. The place where my friends and I discovered it was when it was in syndication. And not just the Channel 13, but it also would be on late night here in the Indianapolis market, particularly on Saturday nights. I remember that was a big deal. If you know, if you were spending the night with some buddies and hanging out, staying up late and watching Star Trek was I'm embarrassed to say, considered really cool in those days.
It's okay to be a nerd. Yeah,
it's all right. Well, I'm comfortable with my inner nerd. I'm comfortable. I made my peace a long time ago. So, well, tell me your story, and then tell me really about how this phenomenon, because it is one of those things that it actually exploded after it was presumed dead.
Indeed, indeed. My earliest recollection of Star Trek, my parents didn't watch it. So the earliest I saw it, which was one of the original episodes during the first run, was we were visiting my uncle, and he was watching it, and I was just completely enamored with the show. I still remember the episode, Devil in the Dark. Mm-hmm. I saw that episode, and I saw another episode down there, Charlie X. Mm-hmm. And I'll remember those two episodes, but it wasn't really until this 1970s when it was in syndication that I really loved it. I'm in Florida, and it came on at 5 o'clock, and my mom would not serve dinner until after 6 when Star Trek was over. But I've often tried to understand what it is about this show that I have such a passion for, and I've, you know, there's so many things, but I'm not sure really what it is, honestly. If it's the relationships with the people, the positive outlook of them, I don't know. But growing up, we could see the moon launches where I lived, and, you know, the whole space vibe of the 60s, and I was really into that. Star Trek just naturally fit into my interest back then, and it, you know, has been ever since.
Well, and Andy and Chris, tell me about how you, the two of you, developed your passion for the series, and then how that began to translate itself into art on your end.
Mine started when I was about 8 years old. I would stay at my dad's on the weekends, and I would watch wrestling on Saturday mornings. Mm-hmm. Probably about noon, it would end, and I just usually turn off the TV. One day, I just kind of let it play and left it on and came back in, and it was the episode, what was it? I think it was actually The Man Trap, because it was in syndication at the time, and mm-hmm. of course, in 1985. And I fell in love with it every Saturday afternoon after that. And it was just wrestling followed by Star Trek every Saturday afternoon. And then eventually the 90s rolled around, Next Gen started coming on, and, you know, it wasn't anything I really got into. Mm-hmm. Like, I would watch it whenever I could. But then my true passion didn't start until I actually joined Five Year Mission. Mm-hmm. And then it's become an obsession since then. And plus, being within the band, you have to know your stuff, because mm-hmm. we play all these conventions and everything. And if somebody asks you a question, you don't want to go, "Well, I don't really watch Star Trek."
Yeah.
So you really have to start learning. You start reading the books. You start reading, like, the encyclopedias and the comics, and going back through and suffer through the animated series for the most part. And yeah, it's just it's become just an obsession, really.
Chris,
I think for me, I couldn't really pinpoint any moment that I started watching Star Trek or discovered Star Trek. I think I'm like a lot of, you know, your average Joe on the street, and you say, "Hey, do you watch Star Trek?" And they're like, "Oh yeah, I watch Star Trek," and maybe they've seen it a few times in their life, and they have really no concept of how big the world actually is. And I didn't either, really, until I found the band and we started doing what we do. And, you know, at first it was just a fun thing to do. You know, we were writing songs about these episodes, and I started watching more and more. And as I went through the episodes and I became invested in the characters, you know, starting with the original series, going on to the Next Generation and then DS9 and so on, you discover that it's not about the action, it's not about the situations, but about the characters and how, you know, how they have evolved. Because it's, you know, the premise is that they are who we are, just in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you have these evolved characters, and then you start going to conventions, and that's when you really see the passion that people have,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, how invested they are. You know, they oftentimes, you know, kind of get blown off as nerds or geeks or whatever. But that's not – it's not just about that. Mm-hmm. It's about this ideal that they aspire to. And to me, I think that's pretty incredible. And so I think – I love the series, but seeing how it can affect people and how deep, you know, the stories actually are, I think that is really where my love started, and it's just grown from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is interesting because there is a certain dismissal of the fan base there at Times Culture. But I think that's evolved. I mean, I think one of the turning points was the film Galaxy Quest.
Yes.
Which really, you know, was tribute disguised as parody.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
And 20 years ago.
And 20 years ago.
Just kind of, that was when Star Trek was 30, not 50.
Yes, right. Yes.
And I think the internet also helps, too, because like Dave, I thought I was the only Star Trek fan growing up for years, and then you get on the internet and you find out there's, you know, thousands and thousands of people who have the same passion as you. So I think that really opened up the fan base as well.
We've if you're just joining us, we are talking about Star Trek on the on its 50th anniversary, which occurs this Thursday. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can track us down on Twitter @WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Janet has done and find us on Facebook @NoLimitsWFYI. If you find us there, you're also going to find some really, really cool artifacts that Dave Arland has brought in here from the Star Trek series that you're going to want to watch or look at. Janet's question is, love Star Trek and watched it most of my life. Can your guests give us more of the inside scoop on why Jeffrey Hunter and his Christopher Pike character were replaced by William Shatner and Captain Kirk?
Well, sure. This is Dave Arland. The original pilot for Star Trek was shot in 1964, and it was an effort by Gene Roddenberry, a TV producer, to create something new. Jeff Hunter played the original captain.
Of course, didn't he have to sell it as, like, Wagon Train in Space or something like that?
You know, he sort of sold it as Wagon Train to the stars.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But in the back of his head, he said, this is going to be a vehicle for me to talk about the things. Now, think about it. 1964, right?
Yeah.
Things that are really important that people need to know about. So Jeff Hunter was hired. He had just played Jesus Christ in a very famous movie. He's a very handsome guy, did a serviceable job. But at the end of the day, NBC didn't buy the pilot. They ordered up a second pilot, which is somewhat unusual. Mm-hmm. Most pilots, you see them burn through on television. This was the strength, frankly, of the backers of the project, and it was none other than Lucille Ball. It was her studio, Desilu, that formed Star Trek and made it, brought it to reality. It was a kind of a case of be careful what you wish for, because it was a very expensive show to produce. And it was Jeff Hunter's wife who said, "Television is below my husband." So he bowed out.
Which is why he's now a trivia answer.
Well, that's,
Shatner's all
that's
over the, yeah.
Unfortunately, he was injured a couple of years later and died. But Bill Shatner was in the wings. And Shatner, by the way, wasn't the first choice to replace Jeff Hunter.
Oh, who was?
Lloyd Bridges.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
From Sea Hunt.
Also Jack Lord.
And Jack Lord.
Hawaii 5-0 was in the running. But and they seriously considered him, but he wanted too big of a piece of the show that they weren't willing to give up. So he was discounted as a candidate.
And Shatner was, you know, a successful TV guy. People remember him from that famous episode of The Twilight Zone where he's got that thing out on the wing, right?
There's a man on the wing.
Yeah.
And the Shat is amazing. I mean, he's 85 years old. He's on an NBC show right now.
Oh, the reality show.
The reality show. And he's got a book coming out next week. And we all just saw him in Las Vegas at Star Trek Vegas. Yep.
Still as spry as ever.
It's amazing.
The show would not have worked as well. I mean, I know initially a lot of the attention went to Leonard Nimoy.
Yes.
But Shatner brought something, and there was one of the analyses, and we may not have time to get to this before we head into the break, was that, and I think this picks up on Dave's point about considering the time in which the show was created, that it was like a fictional representation of John F. Kennedy's New Frontier. And Shatner played a very JFK-like character, you know, a lot of swagger.
like a hard-nosed statesman.
Yes.
But
yes.
He loved the ladies.
Well, yes. Yeah, that's not out of character either. So.
And it's amazing because Shatner was Kirk in the very first pilot that he did, which was the second pilot. He's Kirk. There was no learning curve for him like there was with some of the other cast. He is immediately Kirk, and I always think that's amazing.
Well, we're gonna have to pick this up after the break. We're listening to 5-Year Mission as we go to the break and talking about Star Trek here on No Limits. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. You are listening to 5-Year Mission, which is a local band dedicated to celebrating the legacy of Star Trek through music. Two of the band members, Andy Fark and Chris Spurgeon, are with us, as are Dave Arland of Arland Communications and a well-known local trekker. And Will Smith joining us by phone. He is the operator of TOSGraphics.com. TOS stands for the original series, and he's a Star Trek historian. Andy and Chris, I ought to ask you about, okay, so where do the songs come from?
They come from everywhere. What we do, we're writing one song for every episode of the original series.
In broadcast order.
In broadcast order. We have,
oh my God!
Yeah. Yeah.
So
they're up to season two right now.
I was going to say as if there wasn't enough degree of difficulty.
Right. Well, we break it, since there's too many episodes in a season to put it all on one disc. We break it up into 16 songs per disc, so there will be 5 total, and we include The Cage. We started out with The Cage, which was the original pilot, so that's 80 episodes total. Andy here is our drummer. And so he writes a couple songs now and again, but mostly the songs are written by myself and 3 other guys. What we do is we pretty much literally throw the songs into a hat and draw them out. Or a Gorn mask. And that determines who writes the songs. Now, as far as how we write the songs, we have no rules. It's up in the air. It may be more of like a synopsis kind of song where we kind of hit some high points on the episode and just, you know, write a song about it. We may grab a tiny piece of the episode and write about that. And from time to time, we just kind of grab an idea from the episode, just kind of a feel, and write a song like that. And, you know, your everyday listener may not even realize it's a Star Trek song. You know, we're not writing parodies. Mm-hmm. We're writing, you know, earnest songs about the episodes. Now, some of them do have humorous elements, and some of them are all out, you know, just fun. But we do have, serious songs, too. So it's just kind of depends on who's writing it and what we feel like doing at the time as far as how it comes out.
I'm going to ask what is a simple question, but I don't think there's really going to be a simple. Why does the show work as well as it does? I'm going to ask all 4 of you for your thoughts on that. Andy, I'll start with you since you're I can tell lining up, getting ready to talk. So.
I think initially what grabbed me was for the time that initially premiered, the morality tales of the day. Mm-hmm. Basically, Gene Roddenberry found a way to tackle the day's issues, but in a subtle way. Like racism, misogyny, war, mm-hmm. everything. And it was just so subtle, and people weren't, you know, putting 2 and 2 together. It's like, it's an alien race. That couldn't be about, like, African-Americans being oppressed. This couldn't be about women's rights, because that's a Romulan on screen. Yeah. No, it's morality tales. That's really all it is. It's just, in a roundabout sort of way, it's just I'm holding a mirror up to our current world and just telling these stories, trying to get people to live a better life and strive to build a better future.
Will.
Yeah. And I think Andy's correct. I think that's a great point. But I think most importantly, it's a fun show. You watch it, and as you say, you may not know you're watching something about the Vietnam War, but it's just told in a great story. To me, it's the storytelling. And, of course, Captain Kirk, when I was a kid, I just thought he was an incredible role model. And I just wanted to be Captain Kirk when I grew up, but I didn't become him. But I just think that it was great storytelling, and it just captured your imagination, I think, when you were younger.
Yeah, I was tempted to try to do this show and completely in Shatnerian speech patterns, but that probably would have worn me out and the audience as well. Dave?
I think for me, in addition to the moral story, and certainly I, like Will, I wanted to be Captain Kirk and still do, but there was a key message of infinite diversity in infinite combinations. I'm wearing this kind of 60s medallion. That's a project that Will and I worked on that Gene Roddenberry's son is selling now at Roddenberry.com. That's a project that we worked on with him. And it represents the fact that there are so many different points of view, and those are respected.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is an attitude kind of that needs to be heard in today's America, quite honestly.
Yeah, perhaps even more than it did 50 years ago. Chris.
I have to build on what everybody's said, really. You know, it starts with fun, especially with the original series. It was kind of campy. Maybe it was at the time, I don't know. But now it is, definitely. And, you know, some of the things they did, it's just fun. But, you know, you dig deeper and you find, okay, this is, they do have these social issues that they deal with and you know, greater moral issues. And then you go deeper, you know, no show, no movie, nothing in entertainment can survive without good thought out, you know, well thought out writing and good ideas. And that's really the core of the show. You know, it has great ideas and it has great writing. There are some stinkers as, you know, any series, but overall it just has this great, it endures because it was well done.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about Star Trek, which marks its 50th anniversary this week. If you would like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can give us a call, as a listener named Robert has done, at 866-476-3881. Robert, welcome to the program.
Hello. I love this show. I also love you guys, Chris and Andy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Starfleet rocks, too. just wanted to mention how Star Trek has influenced not only the sciences, but the arts and general diplomacy in the world.
Thanks very much for the call and the question. Will, I'll throw that one to you first.
I couldn't hear the question. I'm sorry.
Could you reframe it a little bit, Robert?
Just trying to, you know, broaden the issue from just being the show itself to the influences the show has had.
Oh, okay.
On so many things, and I think you said science, the arts, and culture.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, Serena Williams.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call and the question. Will?
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
I think that the fact that it's endured so long, you have generations of people watching the show and being inspired by the show, astronauts, engineers, and, you know, physicists, and even me. I'm a contractor, but, you know, I was inspired by Star Trek to draw and start doing plans and whatnot. But I think that the longevity of Star Trek and, you know, its appeal, but it's just captured the imagination of so many people. And, you know, it pushes, I think, it inspires, probably is a better word, people to kind of follow their dreams. And, you know, I think it's a direct reflection on the positive message that so many of the shows have.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Shannon. And again, our email is nolimits@wfyi.org. That's similar in theme. So she says, my dad was an engineer and a total Star Trek geek. We loved watching together. He always said some of those crazy devices would come to pass. through the space program or private industry. I'm thinking of the talk to text episode with Terry Garr as a hapless secretary. What else has come to pass?
Oh, Gary Seven.
Dave. Well, a lot of things have come to pass. I mean, I brought some toys here. You know, we have the communicator,
which is remarkably like a flip phone.
It is remarkable. And this new one that I brought actually makes that little noise, but also
Go ahead and do the full thing here. Go, people have to hear this. Yeah.
Yeah. Kirk to Scott.
Scotty here, Captain.
Scotty, I need warp power.
I'll do what I can, sir.
There you go.
Oh man.
So you can play with it, but obviously this is a cell phone. You know, in fact, the guy who invented the flip phone said that's what I was looking for was the Star Trek communicator.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that is something that has come to pass. And there's any number of things. I think it's interesting. Not only are there things like a cell phone, there's Dr. McCoy's little scanner. There's actually something called the Tricorder X Prize that exists, mm-hmm. trying to build a real tricorder. And so these innovations that were just really props and ideas back 50 years ago were not based on shooting a dart at a dartboard. There were scientific consultants mm-hmm. that were brought in to say, let's look forward 300 years and what is going to be seen. The fact that Terry Garr could speak to a typewriter, an IBM electric typewriter, and have it shoot things back at her is just like Siri. You know, mm-hmm. Siri can do that mm-hmm. today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the things that we see and that we enjoy could be traced potentially to Star Trek's roots. And I also think it inspires in other ways, too. The guys here from Five Year Mission are inspired to be artists. Mm-hmm. Will and I are involved in a project called Star Trek Continues, where we mm-hmm. produce brand new episodes of the old series.
They're fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. And, you know, that's a group of 50 people who donate their time to kind of do a fourth season of the show. We're going to do 12 episodes, and we've done 8 of them so far. So, you know, that's just for fun. And I think the thing that really gets me, and the internet perhaps has made this possible, is you do glom onto people like yourself or people who have a similar interest. And so it does become the relationships. It does become mm-hmm. those people. That's what's really important.
You know, that email brings up a good point, too. This person is writing and says that she used to watch it with her dad, and mm-hmm. this was this great memory.
Mm-hmm.
We hear that all the time. Oh, everywhere. Yeah, I used to watch this with my dad. This brought us closer together. And you see this everywhere. This show is one of those shows that just brings people together.
What's interesting, we've got a Facebook question from a listener named Nick, and you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Nick says, love this show today. Question for your panel. How do they feel about all the reboots and the new upcoming show, Discovery? I'm a fan of the previous shows and wish they would return to that timeline and those stories. They spent so many years developing the characters and worlds and now seem to be only focused on rebooting, rewriting the history from the original series and going back rather than continuing with new stories post-Voyager Deep Space Nine. And the reason I ask that, because it picks up a little bit on what you were saying, Chris. I saw the most recent Star Trek film. I'd seen the three of them with my children in the theater. They really, really loved it.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it. But when they were asking me when we were coming home what I thought of it, my response was, well, yeah, it was good, but maybe it's because of my age and my experience and all that. I'd rather be watching William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, and DeForest Kelly up there rather than, not that these guys are bad or anything like that, but the bonds of affection I have for those characters and the way they played them is so strong that it's hard for me kind of to get past that.
I think for me, I love the new movies.
Yeah.
But not like I love the old movies and the old series.
Yeah, The Wrath of Khan. And
but I think...
Which was basically Into Darkness.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think that the new movies do something really great, and that is they are a gateway to what came before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you watch these new movies and you're like, wow, this is really great, I need more, you have tons more mm-hmm. that you can go back and you can watch. And it's arguably better. Mm-hmm. Now, some people may not agree, but I love the old stuff, but the new stuff... I think that it's for me, the greatest function of the new things is it just brings more people to Trek.
Yeah, that's another thing with the new movies. We've run into a lot of people at conventions telling us that, you know, these new reboot movies are the reason they got into Star Trek. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, people can bash the new movies all they want. I love 2009. I loved Beyond. Did not like Into Darkness so much. But if that is someone's gateway to get into Star Trek, all of the original series, the movies, and everything like that, more power to the reboot. And thank you, Simon Pegg, for bringing us Star Trek Beyond.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I don't want to emphasize, it's just their appreciation for it was so much greater.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're of similar vintage here.
Yes, exactly. Simon Pegg, for those who don't know, plays Scotty in the new
and
Star Trek.
And is a delight. I mean,
and yes. He was the co-writer of the most recent Star Trek Beyond. Yeah. All the silly jokes were in there. You know, yeah. The green hand.
Pegg written all over him.
Yeah. It was great. It makes me cool again to my nephews. That's what I love about the new film.
Exactly.
So I like
about
it.
Me. I think it's for the movies, and I like the movies, but to me, Star Trek is more episodic, and the thing that about the movies is, here we're only on the third movie, and it's been, 7 or 8 years since they started, so almost three times as long as the original series lasted, and there's a loss of continuity, personally, for me. And so I really prefer Star Trek as a television series, because for me, that's what it is, and episodic.
And it's going
to
be
in the movies, they have to do – it has to be so fantastic. Either the Earth is going to be destroyed or the Enterprise is going to be destroyed. And, you know, Star Trek, the original series, was just not like that. It was about their mission exploring. And so I miss that part of it.
I'm really looking forward to that.
Oh, Discovery? I'm Brian Fuller. I have full faith in Brian Fuller to bring us a great new Star Trek series.
And that's the new series that actually is going to start on CBS on its premiere and then go online. So you got to pay extra to get it.
CBS All Access.
Yeah.
I'll pay.
But that'll be good.
I'll pay whatever.
Not only because Brian Fuller is the showrunner who's running the whole thing, but Nick Meyer, who was the director for Star Trek II and the writer of Star Trek II and other old Star Trek
and the sixth
movies.
One, right?
And the sixth
one. Yes. Yeah, yeah.
He's involved. Rod Roddenberry is involved as an executive producer. So it has all the hallmarks of, okay, this is going to be pretty good. It starts in January.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Stephanie. She makes a fair point. Says, women fans, and says, hello. There's so many women who are fans of this show. I am a millennial who began watching when I was a 10-year-old girl. I was inspired by the strong female characters who were leaders, warriors, doctors, admirals in Next Generation. I am disappointed you don't have any women on your panel. I wanted to share a perspective with you, as we are often left out of the conversation. That is a fair point, Stephanie. We did not consider that, and as such, we probably betrayed part of the Star Trek legacy here. So, on the other hand, a listener named Will has said Star Trek worked with an email, said Star Trek worked for one reason, because of the diversity of the regular cast. They were educated and professional in their work as the character and Bones' position as the devil's advocate. You know, some of that is having a cast like that, Dave, I think you alluded to, was just unheard of.
Oh,
back
absolutely.
And
Roddenberry had to fight for it. I mean, he wanted a woman. And here's a little story. Nichelle Nichols, who plays, she's black. She plays Lieutenant Uhura.
And was a huge crush for me and my friends.
She was not a regular cast member. She was not in the budget. So he put her as communications officer because somebody had to sit in that chair behind the captain in all these episodes.
Yeah.
So, you know, that and it was that way. Scotty was not in every episode. You know, some of the minor characters only had limited contracts.
Chris, we're getting ready to head to a break where we're going to hear another one of your songs. And I should say to our listeners, you probably figured this out, but we're talking about Star Trek today on No Limits. Could you talk a little bit about, I think the song is going to be Spock's Brain.
Okay.
Yeah.
We actually did a whole album on the episode Spock's Brain, which if you've watched Spock's Brain, that might be confusing for you, but we have two songs each for the one episode. It created a whole album, and this one is actually just one called R.C. Spock, and it's about how they moved Spock around like remote control on the episode.
You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Survives, but there's no mind. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about Star Trek today on No Limits because this Thursday marks the 50th anniversary of the show's premiere. My guests are Dave Arland of Arland Communications. He's also a well-known local Trekker and historian. Will Smith, also a Star Trek historian and operator of TOSGraphics.com. That TOS stands for the original series. And the music you just heard was from the band 5-Year Mission, which is Star Trek inspired. I have with me in the studio two of the band members, Andy Fark and Chris Spurgeon. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named Jill has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Jill, welcome to the program.
Well, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, you were talking earlier about what makes the show successful and why people were drawn to it, and I've also celebrated my 50th anniversary this year. Started watching Star Trek when I had mononucleosis and I had to spend a whole summer in front of the TV.
Oh, boy.
Wasn't allowed to go outside and play. And I have to admit, science fiction wasn't something that was really in my vocabulary as a small girl. And I started watching that show, and I'm hooked. I'm not quite know it to the name of the title and know every single character's backstory, but I love Star Trek, and when something new comes out, I have to go see it. And I think what made it successful, honestly, from the eyes of the little girl that I was, is that it was utopia. There were people that looked different, spoke different languages, had different cultures, and they all worked together to do the mundane everyday things that they had to do. And it was it was just really cool. It was politically correct, I guess, before politically correct was a thing, but it was just so exciting to see these human beings with different accents and different colors and different cultures working together as sort of one nation. It really was just the coolest thing to me.
Well, thanks very much for the call and for sharing your memories, Jill.
Well, thank you.
Certainly. And while there was that kind of utopian quality to it, I remember some of the episodes also were alarmingly kind of realpolitik kind of balance of power. And there was one episode, I can't remember the title of it, but...
Don't worry, we'll remember.
I'm with the right crowd here. well, the guy who was, it was a send-up sort of a utopian hippie cultures, and the idea that you could achieve peace. Can't remember who the actor.
Hear you, Herman.
Yes.
I can't wait for these guys to do the Way to Eden. That was the space hippies episode.
Absolutely, yes. Space hippies.
Yeah.
Actually, one of the actresses in that episode lives here in Indianapolis. She's an artist up in Carmel.
Mm-hmm.
In the 60s, she was an actress.
And
so.
She's welcome to call in. Share her memories if she would like to.
One of the things that really strikes me over the years is I brought a couple snapshots of Leonard Nimoy at the Indianapolis Marriott several years ago. And all these guys have come, and ladies, have come to town in various incarnations, and some of them have been at conventions. Others have been at, I saw George Takei at a Washington Square shopping mall appearance back in the 80s. I mean, it's just one of the cool things as a fan is being able to talk to these folks whose lives were really transformed by this silly little TV show in the 60s. So it's been fun to get to know some of these folks. Leonard has passed. Bill is still going strong.
But a lot of DeForest Kelly. Is gone.
DeForest is gone, and Jimmy Doohan is gone.
Yeah,
Jimmy's son Chris Doohan is by day a radiologist. He works at Kaiser Permanente in Los Angeles, but he was in the first two reboot films as a transporter technician, and he imitates his father in Star Trek Continues. He plays Scotty.
That's our
connection. Yeah.
Well, let me, because, in some ways for those cast members, at least initially, the show was almost more curse than blessing. Because, Nimoy wrote a book saying, I am not Spock.
And then I am Spock.
Yeah, and then, Shatner had one I think is still one of the single funniest Saturday Night Live bets of all
time.
Get
a life.
Yeah. Move out of your mother's basement. Kiss a girl.
I was living in my parents' basement when that came out.
I know. It was. But, and that's sort of, and even, you know, what we referenced before, Galaxy Quest sort of encapsulated the love-hate relationship that the actors had to have with their characters. Will, could you speak to that a little bit?
Well, as you said, it was a curse, you know, particularly I think for Shatner, because he was so typecast for that. And you look at his string of appearances that he did in the 70s, and nothing really stands out. I mean, what did he do? The Barbary Coast, and he, you know,
Kingdom of the Spiders. That was a good one.
Oh, that was an awesome one.
Yeah, the spider movie, and it was either him or I think it was DeForest Kelly did the one with the giant rabbit, Lupus or something. And but I don't think, I think it was a good 10 years that it was a curse for a lot of those people. In fact, a lot of them made their living going to conventions because they really were so typecast that they couldn't get work in Hollywood.
Well, and in terms of that, how did you guys feel when the show, there were a couple of attempts before it really exploded again. There was the animated series, which I know Andy's not a big fan of. I heard earlier. Although I will say, you know, when my buddies and I, who were, you know, adolescents at the time, had become huge fans of the show, and even one of the things about syndication is you if you are watching every night of the week, it's almost like binge watching now. You can race through
indeed.
The entire run in a hurry, and you're hungry for more of these episodes. We actually looked forward to the animated series, even though by the time it rolled around, it was decidedly not cool to be watching Saturday morning cartoons for an adolescent boy. And we were really excited when the first Star Trek film,
the motion picture,
came out. And
what a disappointment that was.
Yes.
Yeah. The journey to the center of V'ger took about 20 minutes.
Yeah, well, and it just...
Except it seems like 3 hours.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it just didn't seem like the show at all. All the things that we liked about the show, the interplay between the characters and all of that,
And it's such a shame because when it started, I thought it was going to be fantastic because of the opening with the Klingons, which was, I thought, great. And you're just thinking, oh, this is going to be fabulous. And boy, what a letdown when the movie actually started with the familiar characters. But I think that there was a real sense of the relationships that were missing in that movie. It was like these guys were total strangers to each other. It wasn't that warmness that they had in the series for me.
And it's amazing to think that the sets that were built for that movie back in 1979 were used all the way through the Next Generation. I mean, it was just recycled and recycled and recycled over and over again. Harv Bennett came in. He was the producer of $6 Million Man, and he was assigned by Paramount to do another Star Trek movie. We got all this stuff. Let's just make another one. And he teamed up with Nick Meyer to direct it and write it. And, you know, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan is considered like the best of all these movies.
Yeah. Well, and I would agree with that.
I think it's the cheapest movie. The original movie, I think, was $40 million plus. And I think that...
Which was is a lot of money now.
$8 million.
Yeah, but it was a huge, huge sum back in the late 70s.
Yeah.
And Wrath of Khan, I think there was... I remember thinking, feeling a certain amount of trepidation when that came out, and then realizing, they finally got it right. Mm-hmm. They got it right. It's all about the characters again.
Right.
There's this drama. It was fun. Now, do you guys have favorite episodes or favorite films, the ones that just really, really speak to you? I'm going to start with Will on that one and give each of you a chance to think.
My all-time favorite episode. I love all of them, even the terrible ones I love. But my all-time favorite episode is the Doomsday Machine.
Oh, yeah.
With the planet eater.
The Bugle.
And
I think William Wyndham does an incredible job as Commodore Decker, and Scotty's fantastic in it, and Spock's great. And I mean, just a great episode.
Chris.
I think episode-wise for TOS, I am a huge fan of Metamorphosis. I just really like the whole idea. You get to see Zefram Cochrane again, the guy that created the warp drive.
Well, for the first time, really.
Yeah, for the first time, yeah. And so it's just a really cool episode. They kind of explore this bizarre relationship and have a really cool visual at the end. I won't spoil it, but yeah, it's definitely worth checking out.
Mm-hmm. Andy?
I'm going to have to go with Space Seed.
Okay.
Just because it's
the inspiration for the Wrath of God.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's just a great, because I mean, you start getting into the whole eugenics wars and everything, and you know, medical testing and everything like that. But of course, it's the first time we get to meet Khan.
Yeah.
So.
And Ricardo Montalban.
Ricardo Montalban. It's fine Corinthian leather.
Yeah.
I think for me, Conscience of the King, which is a first series.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah,
it's a great
really
episode.
Will. First season piece, and I just think it's a terrific story. It's what they called a bottle show for the most part, meaning that most of it was on the Enterprise itself, which I loved.
Yeah.
I just love the story. It's got some Shakespeare in it, and it's beautifully photographed. First season, they weren't in a huge hurry, unlike everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had a little money.
Right.
Yeah.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Christina, and again, if you want to reach out to us by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. She says, my husband was a student at IU Law School and was taking a Star Trek break from his studies in the open lounge the afternoon I moved into the dorm. He spotted my family and me schlepping my belongings in. As the oldest of 10, we stood out as we each carried one item and had moved me in one trip. He was intrigued and immediately began planning how to meet me. We did meet that very day, and 36 years and 5 children later, in spite of my initial embarrassment of the Trekkie element to the story, I thank Star Trek for facilitating our introduction.
That's awesome.
I love it.
Yeah. Brings people together, see?
See?
So, and the second part of the question I asked, too, is the films... Which ones are your favorites, David?
Probably Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home,
yeah.
the one with the whales.
Yes.
In part because I got to go to Paramount and watch them film part of that. So
oh,
that,
wow.
That
oh,
was
wow.
pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Andy?
Wrath of Khan.
Wrath of Khan?
I have to.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm with Andy on that one, Wrath of Khan.
And I liked First Contact and Undiscovered Country. Both of those are about the same for me.
Oh, okay. So you like the transition to the new series then, too.
Well, it's a solidly written script and a good story. We get to meet the Vulcans. It's Zefram Cochrane's in it. Great. Just a great story. First Contact, I mean.
We've got a tweet from a listener named Doug. And again, the way to reach us on Twitter is at WFYI. Doug asks, how did the five-year mission musicians first find each other, and did they start out with a Star Trek theme?
Ah! I have a feeling this person probably knows our backstory a little bit, just wants us to say it.
Okay,
so Mike, who is another member of the band, this was his brainchild, really. But what it originally started out as a Buffy the Vampire Slayer band. That was the idea, and Patrick, who was another member of the band, he had already written some songs for Buffy the Vampire Slayer. But Patrick moved out to California for a while, and while he was gone, Mike, I think he just really got into Star Trek around that time. And so the idea kind of evolved from Buffy to Star Trek, and then he actually approached Noah, who is the other member of the band that I haven't mentioned yet. With this idea. And we were doing a project at the time that was focused on getting local bands together and local artists and putting on shows for bands and artists that didn't really know how to put on shows. We called it the Midwest Emerging Artists is what it was. And so we were all doing this together, and Mike and Noah were talking about it, and I just kind of heard it and said, hey, this sounds kind of cool.
Butted in.
And then Patrick came back to town, and he was invited, and we auditioned Andy. So it was the creation of the band was all very organic. It just kind of happened, and none of us really planned on you know, it was just kind of something to do for fun, and it just took off. We had no idea.
Blew up.
We had no idea what was going to happen.
So how many, like, conventions or whatever do you do during the course of a year?
I don't. We don't do a whole lot. We maybe three or four
actual conventions,
in the year.
And then like bar shows, all ages shows, yeah. Just regular concerts and things like
but
that.
They but they had oh, they had okay. an audience, John, of 6,000 yeah. people in
right.
Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Three weeks ago. At Star
yeah.
Trek
oh
Vegas.
Yeah, no.
I mean, it was huge.
I'm actually thinking that you probably could, because there's so much of this activity, you could be booked somewhere all the time.
We
right?
could.
We could be, but yeah. we're all. Four out of five of us are dads, yeah. and got day jobs yeah. And everything, so it gets a little tough.
Yeah, unfortunately, the band doesn't, you know, pay the bills, so we have to do it as much as we can.
Yeah.
And we would definitely do it more if we could, but we love doing it, so it's one of those things where, you know, it's our passion, and so we're not sad about not being able to do it all the time. We just love it that we did. Well, yeah, but we just love it that we get to do it as much as we do.
So we've got just a little bit of time left here. I'm going to give each of you about 20 seconds. Is this going to be something, you know, like the James Bond movies that just goes on in perpetuity, that you can reboot? You can recast and all of that. Well, I'm going to start with you, give you about 20 seconds.
Yes, I think it is. I think it's something that people want to see, and it's positive, and I think that it can go on. I think we're going to be talking about this at the 100-year anniversary.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope we all live that long, but that would be good.
This is Dave, and I agree. Dave, I think that this is something that's going to continue. So long as you have stories to tell, Star Trek is a great vehicle to do that.
Andy?
As long as their discovery takes off and there's still demand for it, people still keep attending these conventions like they do, people and their children and their grandchildren are going to have Star Trek in their lives.
Chris, you get the last word.
I don't think Star Trek is something you have to reboot, because there's so many stories to tell, and so there's just so much out there that it's this open world, and there's so much material that they could grab. So I think that Star Trek will continue for as long as people keep watching it and keep loving it.
And I'm assuming, last word for all of you, that on Thursday night you're all going to be watching Star Trek, right?
Absolutely.
Of course.
You're firing up the man trap. That's the first episode.
Matter of fact, can I do a quick shameless plug?
Yes.
We are playing the 50th anniversary show on Friday night at the Melody in 3826 North Illinois. Five-year mission, the Yavin 4, which is Star Wars themed, and Time Crash, which is Doctor Who themed.
Yeah, so come out and see us.
That'll have to be the last word. Not for Star Trek, but for us today. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.
Thank you.